It has all the trappings of an action-packed thriller, with romance, revenge, murder, and war. And its protagonist is a bold and ambitious woman held in awe and feared by legions, described a tigress by one contemporary, willing to eat her young to gain power. Well, the very real story of Caterina took place in 15th century Italy, when great families and popes held sway and vied over vast swaths of territory. At one point, this audacious young mother even held the fate of the papacy in her hands.
She's such an interesting character. She is everything that we attribute to the Renaissance man in a woman.
Elizabeth Lev offers a meticulous and very readable account of Caterina's life in her book, The Tigress of Forlì, Renaissance Italy's most courageous and notorious countess, Caterina Riario Sforza de' Medici. But as biographies go, Caterina's, she says, is mostly an unsung story.
Because some of her characteristics, some of her gifts, some of her qualities and exploits, they fall more under the realm of what people expected from the male Renaissance world. So while there was a sense of women should be educated and they should be able to write Greek and Latin poetry and they should be able to even run courts if necessary, a woman who thought strategically, a woman who was bold and courageous, those are attributes that, being of the more masculine sort, made her contemporaries very uncomfortable.
Caterina was the illegitimate child of Galeazzo Sforza, heir to the Duchy of Milan, who gave her a superb education, a life of luxury, and trained her in the arts of military strategy. Machiavelli himself speaks of her at least three times. With an eye to securing the favor of the papacy and expanding the family's fortunes, her father offered the 10-year-old Caterina in marriage to 30-year-old Girolamo Riario, the nephew of Pope Sixtus IV. Through marriage and a series of intrigues and assassinations, she rose to power in Imola and Forlì, modern-day Emilia-Romagna in northern Italy.
And the territory was part of Emilia-Romagna, which was kind of a sort of ever-shifting series of pseudo-principalities in northern Italy. And due to her marriage to Sixtus IV, Pope Sixtus IV's nephew, Girolamo Riario, the family was given the town of Imola, and then later given the town of Forlì, which at the time was actually the larger of the two towns. And that became a count. It was a territory. It's defined as a count, and therefore she became a countess. Her husband, not a particularly nice man, met a particularly not nice end, and as a result, she, mother of an underage heir, became the regent or effective ruler of these properties, these territories.
For a period, Caterina lived in Rome, where her husband's uncle, Sixtus IV, was pope. It was a time of artistic and architectural ferment, with famous Italian painters such as Botticelli, Perugino, Ghirlandaio, and Pinturicchio making their mark on the city and the Vatican.
Rome was extraordinary. Rome had been left by the Avignon captivity, as they call it, really a mess in the 1300s. And while the popes had sort of begun in fits and starts to pull together the city of Rome and try to give it an infrastructure, it was Sixtus IV who really gave Rome so much of what people know in the city today. He built new churches with beautiful travertine facades. So not as much as we love the beautiful brick facades of Santa Maria in Trastevere, etc., but he gave us the Santa Maria del Popolo. He gave us the Church of now known as Santa Maria della Pace. He gives, of course, the Sistine Chapel. But these new churches that appeared in the heart of Rome with these broad travertine white facades reminiscent of antiquity, he had the first bridge to span the Tiber since antiquity, that lovely little pedestrian bridge, Ponte Sisto. He built new roads. He got the Aqua Vergine aqueduct working. And then to crown all of this spade work to put Rome back on his feet, he opened the world's first public museum, which is the Capitoline Museum. So I imagine Caterina sitting there watching, so there's a whole section on this, watching this urban transformation of Rome, watching buildings go up, seeing the dream team of Renaissance art show up in the Sistine Chapel. So there's Botticelli, and there's Perugino, and there's Ghirlandaio, all kind of, you know, walking in, the toughest painters in town wielding those brushes, and all the nobles in Rome kind of dashing into the Sistine Chapel to see if they can have their portraits done. Of course, Caterina will be portrayed in the Sistine Chapel.
But just where can we find the figure of Caterina in the Sistine Chapel?
The traditional attribution was that she was one of the daughters of Jethro. But when I was looking over the paintings more attentively, there's a female figure in what we sometimes call the Temptation of Christ in the Desert. And it was directly across from where Sixtus IV would have sat. So he was looking at that, and it contains members of his family. So you have her husband, Girolamo Riario. You have Julius II, the future Julius II, still is cardinal. And then there is a woman who is pregnant. Caterina, I have to say, was virtually always pregnant.
She had, six kids?
She had six kids by her first husband. Then she had a couple, two random ones in the midst there afterwards. And then she's got a little baby at her feet. She's carrying a bunch of wood. She was not the sort of person to sit around when she was pregnant. And there's a little serpent crawling up between them. And since her family name Sforza, their symbol is the viper, I suspect it's her, that particular figure.
Caterina also lived under two other popes, Innocent VIII and Alexander VI, the formidable Borgia Pope.
Innocent VIII was a relatively, she was in Forli during that time, and the way that insofar as his relationship with Caterina is concerned is that every now and then he would sort of look over at her lands and think, well, I could take it away from her and give it to my nephew, but why bother? He wasn't very proactive. Alexander VI had every intention of forming an entire state out of Romagna and giving it, of course, to the infamous Cesare Borgia. The magnificent irony is that Alexander VI shows up at the beginning of the book because he was the godfather to her eldest son, and then he shows up sort of towards the denouement when you have, you know, Alexander VI's army led by Cesare, which is going to try to take her town. And she saw, in many ways, Sixtus, albeit famous for his nepotism, Sixtus was a very good and holy and devout man. He's the one who gave us the Immaculate Conception on the universal calendar. He personally, as Pope, went to pray every Saturday at Santa Maria del Popolo with members of his family. So all the visitors coming in from the northern gate on Saturday would say, oh, what's that? Oh, that's the Pope going to pray to Mary, say his rosary. So, I mean, in first person, a tremendous example. So he was a very devout person, but he and I discuss a bit of this papacy in the book because it's a little hard to understand this question of the nepotism and yet a man who was very devout. So she saw a man who was very good and holy as Pope, and then she saw Alexander VI. And what's fascinating to me about Caterina, what I think is very actual for our times, is that Caterina saw a far worse church than you and I will ever see. The church isn't there yet. Can you imagine an Alexander VI getting elected today? It just can't happen. And so she looked into the heart of a church at that time, which was about as worldly and secular. Members of the church who did truly, truly, truly wicked, wicked things. She knew many members of the church who did wonderful things, self-sacrificing priests and religious sisters who went first person to help her. And so she never kind of got caught up in the church is so horrible, these people are so horrible, I'm going to lose my faith. She never used that. She never actually used excuses of any sort in her life, which is, I think, what I admire the most about her. She was never, this happened to me when I was a child, so I'm going to sit back and pout. This Pope treated me this way, so I'm going to complain for the rest of my life. She was a doer, and she just thought about how to get over things. And when it was time to get over the difficulties of her life, she used the tools the church gives us, the expiation, repentance, offering up sacrifice. Remarkable.
In one of the most rocambolesque episodes of her life, the 7-month pregnant Caterina grabs her horse and trains the canons of St. Angelo Castle on the College of Cardinals to prevent them from electing a new pope.
This is one of the ones when I started looking at her and going, hey, you're my kind of girl. Sixtus IV dies in 1484, and during the last couple years of his pontificate, his nephew, her husband, Girolamo Riario, had managed to enrage every single person in Rome, particularly the College of the Cardinals. So it is very apparent that everybody is waiting for the Pope to die so they can take their revenge on Girolamo. The only thing that's standing between Girolamo and an angry mob is the Pope. The Pope dies. Girolamo, in what will turn out to be his greatest characteristic, goes tearing to the countryside and sort of waves his fist from inside the fortress of a friend of his, leaving his wife. She was 7 months pregnant. She realizes if the College of the Cardinals meets, they elect a new pope. The first pope, the very first thing he's going to do is he's going to cancel the counts of Imola and Forlì, and that means her children's birthright will be gone and they'll have nothing. And so she gets on a horse and she rides into the Castel Sant'Angelo, the fort of Rome, and she trained all the canons on basically the house of the College of the Cardinals where they were supposed to meet for the conclave, so none of them could get there. And so the funeral of Sixtus IV was delayed, and then finally like two people went because nobody could get over there. The conclave was delayed until finally the cardinals agreed to continue the privileges of her husband. But the best part of that, this was the line that really it cemented Caterina for me forever. They sent her nephew, considerably younger than she was, and very, very in his own right, he was a kind of frightened little rabbit type. And they send him along, now that he's a cardinal, to talk to her. And so he shows up and he starts talking to her like, well, you must be very tired and you're pregnant, you're probably stressed out, and I think you should come down from there, Caterina. And she halts him and she says, you think you can talk to me that way because I'm a woman. These are her textual words. But you forget that I'm the daughter of Galeazza Maria Sforza, and I think like him too. And that statement, talking about her father, who was a great military strategist, and claiming that capacity to strategy, an amazing thing. And then she walks out of the Castel Sant'Angelo, this is a fashion note, wearing a brown dress. And instead of the usual accessories, if you like a purse and a parasol, she's got a belt with a sword and a sack of money, which is what lords used to wear. So she walks out, she's already something fabulous. She's 21 years old.
My goodness. But she had for a number of days or hours the papacy in her control.
Days. It was days.
But she had a terrible vindictive side to her. I read that she took revenge on entire families for the murder of her second husband. I mean, surely you can't make the excuse that she was just simply living in those times. Come on. Can you forgive a person like that?
Yeah, you can't contextualize that one with, oh, well, the people used to, the Renaissance used to do that all the time. It's not. It shocked all of Italy. I found that I understood all of a sudden when I went to write this biography. Again, you've selected the moments that are the most critical for me in writing it. When I found that moment in her life, I was like, oh, now I see why there are not many biographies, because you just look at it and you think she did. She killed or allowed to be killed a number of families, including children. And you just look at that and go, wow. And, you know, it's a moment in her life when she was overcome by passion for the second husband. She was in love, the stable boy. I mean, you know, it was not one of the more suitable marriages. Everybody was annoyed. He had clearly been killed by someone on the inside of her family. She was enraged and she was thwarted and she was angry. And what's the most interesting part? She was powerful. She was really powerful. She wasn't hiding behind her husband's power. She gave orders and the orders got done. And I think it's a very interesting note on that headiness and the blindness the power can bring. So this woman who thought she could handle anything, but what she couldn't handle was extreme stress, violent emotion, and power. And the three of them together resulted in this massacre. And what is fascinating is what you said, that my favorite part is, how do you forgive her? And, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm like, wow, that's a mess. Good luck coming back from that. Well, how do you seek forgiveness? Because you must seek forgiveness. That's what it means to be part of our tradition. You make a mess. You can't just say, oh, well, didn't happen. And you can't, you know, go and commit harikiri. You have to find a way to repent and reform and make up for it. And so she, after this very long period, there'll be a moment when she starts to get in touch with Savonarola. Savonarola, of all people, the famous fiery Dominican preacher that everybody can't stand. And yet...
And who was put to death.
And was put to death by Alexander
VI.
Ooh. The she gets in touch with him, as her third husband is a Medici, and he writes her a letter talking about expiation, talking about, we don't have her letter, but we have his letter to her, in which he talks about what one needs to clean one's soul. So it looks like she's trying to find a way to expiate this. He puts her in touch with a group of religious sisters called the Murate in Florence, which will be the rest of her life. She will have a connection with these sisters. She'll take a room in there. And when the most horrible event of her life takes place, she, at a moment when most everybody else would just kind of give up and say, I'm done, she learns to channel all of the things that are happening to her as a form of expiation. And so I think that's what gives her the strength to survive what, you know, all her other cellmates in the Castel Sant'Angelo die, but she walks out at the end.
Has she rubbed off on you and the way you look at your own faith?
She's like a very good friend. When she looks at things and says, you know, wow, this is a problem, and then she looks beyond it. She knew how to look beyond it. There are a few things in her character that I hope I don't pick up.
Well, I would hope so. Yeah,
there are a couple things there that I'm hoping aren't rubbing off in the opposite direction. But I found her a 15th century woman. She lived her life with all of the sins and the passions and the desires and the needs that one has as a mother trying to raise your children in the world. She lived as a strategist, but she also lived as a Christian. I don't think we're going to be opening a cause for sainthood for Caterina soon, but this is a woman who had an extraordinary life. And in that extraordinary life, she held fast to that rope of faith. Sometimes she was under, sometimes she was over, but she held fast to it. And in a world where today, it's so easy. People are so quick to drop that rope. Like, oh, this isn't working for me. And, oh, this church. Or, oh, this is, you know, or I've done something so horrible I can't go back from it. You know, I think particularly when you look at sinfulness and you think, well, gosh, I've been pretty awful. Oh, she was worse. I haven't massacred any families yet. So the fact is that I find her an excellent guide of someone who was steadfast in everything, steadfast even in her faith.
Elizabeth Lev is the author of The Tigress of Forlì, Renaissance Italy's most courageous and notorious countess, Caterina Riario Sforza de' Medici.